You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hello out there in archaeology podcast land. This is Dr. Alan Garfinkel. I'm the president and founder of the California Rock Art Foundation. And what we do is we identify, evaluate, manage, and conserve rock art both in Alta California and in Baja California. We conduct field trips, we have trainings, exercise, we do research, and in every way possible, we try to preserve, protect, and coordinate treasures of Alta and Baja California rock art, of which there are many and diverse. We also work closely with Native Americans and partner with them to recognize and protect sacred sites. So for more info about the fabulous California Rock Art Foundation, you can go to carockart.org. Also, I'm open to give me a call, 805-312-2261. We would welcome sponsorship or underwriting, helping us to defray the costs of our podcasts, and also membership in California Rock Art Foundation. And of course, donations, since we are a 501c3 nonprofit scientific and educational corporation. God bless everyone out there in podcast land.
You're listening to the Rock Art Podcast. Join us every week for fascinating tales of rock art, adventure, and archaeology. Find our contact info in the show notes and send us your suggestions.
Welcome, everyone, to the 45th episode of our Rock Art Podcast. This is Dr. Alan Garfinkel interviewing Sandy Rogers, a luminary in the fields of rock art and in obsidian dating. Enjoy. Hey, out there in archaeology podcast land, this is Dr. Alan Garfinkel, and this is episode 45 of your Rock Art Podcast. And we are honored and blessed to have a remarkable individual, Sandy Rogers, Alexander Rogers. Sandy has been a influential and prestigious scholar in a number of different fields. One is on rock art, but another certainly is relating to his archaeological studies that integrate his scientific emphasis on the dating of obsidian in an archaeological context. And as well, he's a remarkable individual in the sense that he has two master's degrees, one in archaeology and one in physics, and is an absolutely brilliant researcher. He has published literally dozens of articles in major scientific journals that have been peer-reviewed and are very well-received. Sandy Rogers, are you there?
Yes, I am. Hello, Alan.
Well, it's a blessing to have you, and I know we've tried to do this for a while, and we're both geographically in the wonderful state of Oregon, are you?
Right.
Yeah. What takes you to Oregon in this interesting benchmark in your life?
Well, we decided to move here about a year and a half ago to be closer to children and grandchildren. That was a primary reason. And so we are here now in Hillsboro. Two of our sons and their families are nearby.
Whereabouts is Hillsboro in Oregon?
Hillsboro is on the west side of Portland.
I see.
Probably about a dozen miles west. It is a big time Intel corporation country out here.
So you were formerly living, I believe, in Ridgecrest for certainly a portion of your life, weren't you?
Yes. As a matter of fact, for most of it, I first went there in 1949 in the first grade, my parents. After I got my master's in physics, I went to work there at the, it was then called the Naval Weapons Center, China Lake. It's a Navy laboratory. And I worked there for most of my career, spent a year in the Pentagon, and 5 years, I guess it was, at Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Laboratory. But most of my career was at China Lake, which is a wonderful place to work if you're a scientist or engineer. It also happens to be where the COSO rock art is located.
So let's have a thumbnail of, for those who may not know, where is Ridgecrest? What is China Lake?
And okay. China Lake is a Navy base in the eastern California part of the Mojave Desert, upper Mojave Desert. It's a huge base, about 1,700 square miles. It's a laboratory and test range for the Navy, Naval Aviation. So in that 1,700 square miles, there is a large amount of archaeology and rock art, which is has been identified as being protected. The town of Ridgecrest is just to the southwest of China Lake, and is a basically a bedroom community of about 30,000 people, and it's where everybody who works on the base lives. But this is all in the eastern part of California. If you visualize California, it's kind of between Bakersfield on the west and Death Valley on the east.
I see.
It is open desert.
So, Sandy, you find yourself in Ridgecrest for most of your life. You began as a physicist, but that particular portion of your career at some point shifted, did it not?
Yes. I became interested in archaeology and rock art in the course of a career. My grandmother was very interested in anthropology. My father, who was also a physicist, was interested in archaeology, and I kind of acquired it from them. But then, of course, being right there next to COSO and the rock art field there, I think the first time I went there was probably about 1950 when I was in the second grade. It has quite an influence on you. And so as time went on, I became very interested in that. And when I retired from my career in physics, that was in 2002 after almost 40 years, I then went back to graduate school and got a master's degree in archaeological anthropology at Cal State Bakersfield.
Now, isn't that rather rare for someone to have a master's in physics and then twin it at a different portion of their lives and get another master's degree in archaeology?
It certainly is unusual. Actually, there were a fair number of people I knew in the Navy Department who had two master's degrees in totally unrelated fields. But this is the only one I'm aware of, which combines a physical science with anthropology.
So you got a second degree in archaeology. Maybe for those that, again, may not be exceptionally familiar, we know that you lived in Ridgecrest and we know that you were a physicist on base. And you said you had some interest in COSO rock art. Tell us just a thumbnail of what COSO rock art meant to you and what it is.
Okay. Before I do that, let me backtrack just a little bit. But after I retired from the Navy Department, I always want to say graduated, but the proper term is retired, and got my master's in anthropology. I then worked in Ridgecrest as the archaeological curator at the Matarango Museum, which is a museum of archaeology and local cultural history in Ridgecrest. It's a repository for the BLM, and it's a wonderful place to work like that because you have access to collections for study. Also, the Matarango Museum conducts tours of the COSO rock art. These are tours which are approved by the Navy because it's on an active military range. And so the tours, though, that the museum conducts are typically on weekends in the spring and the fall. You don't want to be up there in the COSOs either in the midsummer or midwinter. And as a tour escort, I got to see the rock art up close a great deal and became very interested in it, and also became familiar with some of the questions people ask and also some of the literature associated with it. So that was kind of how the connection with COSO rock art came about there. The rock art itself is probably the most extensive collection of rock art, I would say, in the Western Hemisphere. I know there are other concentrations like the recently discovered ones in Central America, which are very intense. But the thing about COSO is not only is it intense, but it literally goes on from mile after mile after mile, one canyon after the next canyon in these volcanic mountain ranges. And I don't know, I don't think anybody could ever calculate it, but I would not be surprised if there were 500,000 images in the whole COSO rock art field.
That's amazing. Absolutely remarkable. So what is it about the rock art and about your interest in physics that kind of was twinned, and how would that have applied to your interests and your association with the Matarango Museum?
Well, one of the most difficult issues in rock art, as you know, is dating the stuff, determining an age. there have been various methods proposed for direct dating. I am skeptical of most of them. They have some validity. They're after all, we're talking about a geochemical process here, and so it's not terribly accurate. One of the better methods for estimating age is by the age of associated archaeological sites, archaeological artifacts. And so from that, since there's obsidian everywhere in the Great Basin and the California desert, I got interested in obsidian dating. And that was where I really started applying the physics to an archaeological issue.
What was it about obsidian dating in rock art that tugged at your heart? And how did that integrate in a way that provided, I'd say, some revelations or some discoveries? How's that?
Interestingly enough, the motivation for getting into obsidian hydration, the science of obsidian hydration, was provided by one of the professors at Cal State Bakersfield, who absolutely detested obsidian hydration dating and was convinced it would never work. And so that made me feel, okay, I'm going to show you it does. And so I have worked on that for about 16 years now and have established along with other colleagues, of course, not just on myself, the physical and chemical basis of how the hydration process works and develop the mathematical models which allows one to compute ages and age uncertainties in a consistent and reproducible manner. And so that allows one to estimate the age of rock art by association. The classic case of association, of course, was Kidder and Guernsey back in the 1920s, 100 years ago, in northern Arizona, where they discovered that there was a absolute 100% correlation between basket maker rock art and location of basket maker sites. And to the extent they state this in one of their publications, that they used the presence of rock art to determine where the sites were. And so it does, in fact, work. You always have to be careful, of course, because you can get off on a false tangent there. But association with sites and association with artifacts does, in fact, work a surprising number of times.
So what have we learned about the age of Coso rock art vis-a-vis your study of obsidian and integrating those particular disciplines and studies together?
I think my conclusion I came to was that the classic Coso sheep, the boat-shaped body with his head turned so it looks like the face is looking at you, is probably relatively late, around Newbury period, probably between 2,000 and 3,000 years old. And the pattern body anthropomorphs are similar, perhaps a little bit older, maybe back to 4,000, but again, mostly Newbury period. That said, however, there seems to be a fair amount of rock art there in the Cosos, which goes all the way back to Paleo-Indian periods. It's hard to nail down particular motifs associated with the very old ages, except for the general appearance of being primitive and of being heavily repatinated. But I do think that the rock art goes all the way back to Paleo-Indian times, and that the majority of it, though, is probably within the last 3,000 to 1,000 years.
What would you say the takeaway is from your research with obsidian studies and Coso rock art? What is some of the, I'd say, the most revelatory, interesting, or insightful, something that you really want to share again with our listeners?
The main thing which strikes me is that there is an incredible time depth to it. This is not all recent stuff. It's not a short time, but there is a huge time depth, probably over 10,000 years, associated with that Coso rock art. And by the way, the Coso rock art, I should comment, is almost entirely petroglyphs, carvings. There is a very small number of pictographs, paintings, but they are fairly recent, apparently. And the vast majority, you know, 99.something% is petroglyphs.
I know that you've integrated, you know, a variety of different explanatory models and perspectives on the study of Coso rock art in general. Do you have any particular sort of take on this or particular, because as you and I are well aware, the Cosos has kind of been sort of a centerpiece for rock art controversy worldwide.
Yes, they have. I guess the main thing which has been striking me more recently is the difficulty of interpreting. Interpretation, in fact, from my perspective, I've just been thinking about this. Interpretation actually has two aspects to it. One would be an intellectual aspect, a kind of an ethic aspect, and the other would be the emic kind of gut level aspect to interpretation. I think that the intellectual external interpretation, such as how does rock art fit into what we know of a culture, that is a thing which is, can be reasonably studied, and I think can be beneficially studied. On the other hand, I think that the emic kind of gut level reaction to rock art probably can't be studied by us because we're not part of the same culture. And we don't know how those people perceived it or how they reacted to it at a personal level. But as I say, we can try to understand how the rock art fits into a culture and how it fits into its worldview.
Nice. Well, I think that's going to be it for the first segment. And I guess on the next segment, we'll dig a little deeper into some of the insights and reflections on your work, both for Obsidian Dating and Koso Rock Art. See you on the flip-flop, gang. Welcome back to the Rock Art Podcast on the Archaeology Podcast Network. This is your host, Dr. Alan Garfinkel, and we have a remarkable gentleman, Sandy Rogers, with us. He's a gifted scholar, someone who's very familiar and very noted for his scientific studies of rock art, but also in the field of obsidian dating. And we're going to talk about some of the overlap and the integration of his work and how that all ferreted out vis-a-vis his life's work and contribution to the study of rock art. Sandy, are you there?
Yep, I'm right here.
Sandy, it's wonderful. On that first segment, we covered a wide range of topics. Maybe we can drill down on a specific aspect of your research. I know that you've published rather extensively on obsidian hydration dating. And how does that specifically relate to your work with Koso rock art dating in sort of setting up, let's say, the categories, the differences, or in terms of how you have come to understand the meaning, function, and particular patterning on some of these rather testy questions relating to the nature and antiquity of Koso rock art?
Well, that's a big question.
Of course.
Well, I think that any question worth answering is a big one.
Yeah.
I think that the importance of the obsidian hydration dating is that it enables one in a very simple, straightforward way to determine ages of obsidian artifacts, which may be associated with archaeological sites and with panels, rock art sites. So it gives us at least a possible handle on the ages of the rock art by correlating, basically, let me back up. Right, obsidian hydration dating was used extensively in the paperwork which recommended creation of the Koso Rock Art National Historic District. It's a good way of dating, and in many cases, there was no radiocarbon or other chronometric sources available. So all you had was a projectile point typology and obsidian hydration dating.
And the critical thing is, as you would say, if you can't date it, you can't really talk about it very well in terms of cultural evolution or prehistoric life ways or culture change or anything.
Well, exactly. You can't, unless you can fit it into a cultural sequence somewhere, it's pretty hard to draw much in the way of conclusions about it. Because I have seen some rock art, which is very, very recent, but which is made to look like the old stuff. It's very easy to fake. And so you really need to be able to get a scientifically valid estimate of age. And once you can do that, you can start to fit it into cultural sequences.
Now, Koso is rather special when it comes to obsidian, I think, because of the volume and the treasure of volcanic glass that's available to its Aboriginal inhabitants.
Yes, I should have commented on that, that the Coso rock art area, the field, the historic landmark, is no more than 5 or 10 miles to the east of the Coso volcanic field, which is one of the biggest and most prolific sources of obsidian on the West Coast, or at least in California. Huge amounts of obsidian all over California came from Coso. One of the beauties of obsidian is that you can source it. There have been laboratory techniques developed using X-ray fluorescence to identify the source of a piece of obsidian. And there are labs which provide this service very inexpensively. So there was an article back in, I think, 2011 in Science by John Erlandson and colleagues on the Channel Islands off the coast of California. And they reported finding a piece of obsidian from the Coso volcanic field, specifically from West Sugarloaf Quarry on Coso volcanic field on Santa Rosa Island. And it was in a context they could date with radiocarbon to 11,200 years. So this trade or exchange of obsidian has been going on for a very, very long time. And in fact, we find that the obsidian was traded from the Coso volcanic field, from the Coso region, traded to the west. And what they received in return was marine shell beads. We find lots of marine shell beads in archaeological sites in the eastern California desert. They all of them came from the coast of California as a result, most likely as a result of the obsidian trade. So this there's a huge amount of obsidian, and it is literally all over the Coso rock art area. You can't go anywhere without stepping on the stuff. The poster child, of course, is Little Lake Ranch, which is private property. It's on the west side of the Navy base, and there are sites there where the whole ground simply sparkles with obsidian flakes, all of which was culturally modified, so that it has been used for a very long time, which makes it a very useful item for dating.
So in terms of this 10,000 or more year prehistory and use of obsidian, was there much change in use over that time, or was there periods of peaks and valleys, or how did that sort of ferret out?
Yes, there were definitely peaks and valleys. In the very earliest times, we're not quite sure, because most of the obsidian from that era, all you find is waste flakes, debitage. In fact, I was doing an analysis for a guy down in Santa Barbara for an archaeological site, and there was obsidian there. It was just debitage, but it was Coso West Sugarloaf. And by the way, that was very, very old. That was paleo also, around 10,000 years. But those are very small pieces of debitage or waste flakes. The peak era seems to have been, again, in that Newberry period, around 4,000 down to roughly 1,500 years ago. It seems to have been when the peak trade was taking place. And in that case, the obsidian being traded was beautiful stuff. It was shaped into bifaces and was transported then across the mountains to the east, to the west. I mean, as you know, there's the Little Lake biface cache of Coso obsidian, which is curated at the Matarango Museum. There is also a cache called the Hay Ranch biface cache, which is older. It's about roughly 2,500 years old. And that was from Rose Valley, California. And again, it is beautifully shaped obsidian bifaces. And these were traded again across to the west. From what we can tell, however, the trade pretty much dropped off after roughly 1,500 to 1,200 years ago. And the interpretation is that it was because that coincided with the introduction of the bow and arrow. Previous to that, the primary hunting weapon was the spear or the thrown dart, thrown with an atlatl or spear thrower. And it takes a fairly large projectile point, maybe 2, 3, 4 inches in length. And that in turn takes a fair amount of obsidian. And so that was probably what the obsidian trade was supplying. After the bow and arrow was introduced, however, arrow points are very tiny. In fact, the desert series points are little more than tiny slivers of volcanic glass. And you don't need great big bifaces for that. All you need is waste flakes. And so it is very likely that the demand for the obsidian bifaces simply went away, like we see markets collapse today, when the atlatl and dart were replaced by the bow and arrow.
So that's quite a story of the obsidian trail.
Yes.
So how does all this figure into the lifeways, religion, cosmology? You know, why are all these pictures all over the rocks there in the Cosos? What's the deal?
Well, there's a, as you know as well as I do, there are many, many interpretations of that. Uh-huh. At last count, I count about 13 respectable interpretations, respectable in the sense that they're published in the scientific literature. And there's innumerable numbers of wacko interpretations, but the strongest interpretations, the most likely interpretation, I should say, that I'm aware of, revolve around their function as a part of society. Marcia Dobres, I think it is, at Berkeley, mm-hmm. has suggested that rock art, that the creation of rock art may have been as important as the product was, that it may have reinforced social roles and social identities. Now, her argument was based on France, Lascaux, and mm-hmm. Chauvet. But it would occur also for Koso. And I think there's a great deal of validity to that. On the other hand, I think it also has to have some function within the society. And I tend to be of the opinion that it was involved in some fashion with rites, shamanistic rites, religious rites involving the bighorn sheep. Bighorn sheep are overrepresented in rock art relative to the archaeological record. There's sheep bone in the archaeological record, but not that much. Not as many as there are images on the petroglyph panels. So I suspect that the bighorn was a symbol of something, maybe a symbol of a major animal. And also, it may very well be that they had been overhunted. I've seen archaeological evidence that in the Newbury period, 4,000 to about 2,000 years ago, there was a population increase in the California desert. We certainly see that in terms of sites in the Coso uplands on the Navy base. And so if there was a population increase, it's entirely possible that the sheep were being overhunted. From what I understand, bighorn sheep do not reproduce terribly well. And so it does not take very much to overhunt them. They're also not especially bright. And so an expanded population armed with atlatls and darts, and then subsequently, of course, armed with a bow and arrow, which is even more lethal, could very easily have overhunted the sheep. And we know also from cross-cultural studies that the typical response to overhunting was religious. Certainly in the Pacific Northwest, they returned bones of the salmon to the river so the salmon would come back. And I suspect that in this case, in the Cosos, they were creating images of sheep to encourage the reappearance of sheep.
So it sounds like to me that we had a very lively society, and one that endured, and one that was rather religious, and one that depicted what mattered to them, certainly adorning the rocks. And it was a very abundant means of representing their theology. Am I correct?
That would be my interpretation.
Yeah, interesting.
And certainly we know that the lifeway of those people was quite successful. Now, I could not have done it. I can't survive without a convenience store. But for them, the desert was their convenience store. And they moved around, seasonal transhumance with the seasons. And they were a very successful cultural adaptation for thousands of years, a lot longer than we've been here.
Remarkable. Absolutely remarkable. Well, thank you. Well, that's going to be the finish up of our second segment, gang. And we're going to close out the next segment with some final reflections from Sandy Rogers about some of his latest discoveries and revelations. See you on the flip-flop. Gang, welcome back to your Rock Art Podcast with Dr. Alan Garfinkel. We're here at the Archaeology Podcast Network, and we're going to close out with the third segment with our remarkable guest scholar, Sandy Rogers. Sandy.
Yes, indeed.
You've shared some tremendously interesting insights and wisdom. How would you like to close out our episode with some of your latest discovery, revelations, perhaps, that you feel are relevant to our understanding of the ancients of the coastal range?
Okay. Over the last, maybe 3 years, I've become more interested in the interrelated question of linguistics and genetics in this area. We all remember what Franz Boas said many years ago, that you have to look on three different dimensions in anthropology of culture and linguistics. He called it language, and genetics, which he called race. But culture, linguistics, and genetics are three interrelated topics, but they're not identical, and you confuse them at your peril. And unfortunately, of course, in archaeology, all we get to deal with is material culture for the most part, because that's all it preserves in the archaeological record. And so that, by the way, is one of the reasons why rock art is so valuable, because it gives us at least possibly an insight into ideology in addition to the material culture, but you have to be real, real careful about that. But recently there's been some interesting material discovered, and I'll start with the genetics. Back in 2018, I believe it was, in Science, there was a paper published by the S.K. Willerslev ancient DNA team at the University of Copenhagen. It was in about October or November of that year, and I remember because I was at the Great Basin Anthropological Conference, and that that paper was all the talk of in the hallways. It had just come out. And what these folks at Copenhagen has succeeded in doing was they did DNA studies on three individual cases. One was the present-day Paiute of the, I believe it was the Fallon Band Paiute in Nevada. The second was the Lovelock Cave human remains from Nevada, which are dated to about roughly 1,400 years ago. The third one was the Spirit Cave human remains, again from Nevada, which are about 14,000 years. And what they were able to demonstrate, to everyone's surprise, was genetic continuity over that whole period, from Spirit Cave to Lovelock Cave to the present day. Now, that is a long period of time for a genetic continuity. And my suspicion is, although this is, of course, in western Nevada, my suspicion is that a similar genetic time depth would exist in the Coso region. We know that the peoples were very related, and so I would be very much surprised if we didn't have that similar time depth. We just don't have any particular way of verifying it. Then from the point of view of linguistics, there's been a theory for a long time, going all the way back to Kay Fowler back in 1986 or so, that the ancestors of the present-day inhabitants of the Eastern California desert were in that area about 6,000 years ago, or these people who spoke that language, Proto-Northern Uto-Aztecan, were there 6,000 years ago. She based her argument on linguistics and on words which occur in the present-day language, which seem to reflect that arena, that area. Since then, of course, David Shull and various colleagues have argued for a time depth back to more like 10,000 in that area. So again, what we have here is a very interesting confluence between apparently linguistics and genetics in this Eastern California area. And so I would suggest that this would indicate to me, at least, that for the Coso rock art, that we know there were people there 13,000 years ago because they made the Paleo-Indian artifacts we find. We find Clophis points, we find Western stem tradition points, we find crescents, all these things which are Paleo-Indian in age. So we know people were there. We now have reasonably good evidence, at least circumstantial. There were folks there who spoke at least a proto Utoaztecan language between 6,000 and 10,000 years ago, and they may very well go back before then. Then finally, we have this genetic continuity, which admittedly is in Western Nevada, but that's very similar to Eastern California. There was no state line in those days. And so, that again, that goes back 10,000 years, and there may be greater time depth than that. So what all that would suggest to me is that for the origination of the Coso rock art, the rock art there was probably created by people who were the genetic and probably linguistic forebears of the present-day Native American populations. Now, I realize that's a big statement to make, but I've kind of painted myself into a corner on that, but I think this is valid. And so the time depth, again, is very, very long, and it actually extends up to the present, I think. Now, the ethnographic present there was the Coso or Panamint Shoshone, and the present-day Timbishaw are their descendants. So I am really of the opinion that the rock art there in that area, at least the petroglyphs, was created by people who are the ancestors of the present-day Native American inhabitants of the area.
Pretty amazing stuff. Really amazing. When you think about it in a broad way, that would mean that sort of the Great Basin Paiute Shoshone, the folks we call Nummik, have distant relationships with the Hopi, who are Utoaztecan in the American Southwest, and then even connections to northern Mexico, the Huichol and the Aztec.
Yes, they do. And there was a study done by Christy Turner back about 1997 or thereabouts of teeth. And what he did was he looked at the dentition. I don't remember. It was like a 1,000 or 1,200 teeth he examined, which must have been a heck of a task, from all over the Southwest and also from Northwest Mexico. And what he concluded was that the people in the Southwest, whom we would call Western basket maker, who, by the way, were probably Utoaztecan, shared dentition with Northwest Mexico.
Oh, my word.
So, and it's a very interesting set of conclusions he came to.
So again, this shows the tremendous continuity, genetic, cultural, linguistic continuity spanning enormous lengths of space and geography and environmental heterogeneity to some extent, correct?
Yes, and there's another kind of a wild card here that I'll mention. I hope this doesn't fall in the wacko category. But some years ago, I was got interested in the subject of a disease called valley fever, coccidioidomycosis, San Joaquin Valley Fever. It turns out that the Mayo Clinic is the experts on this. And although it's called San Joaquin Valley Fever, it's actually more in Arizona and in New Mexico than it is in California. There was a map published by the Mayo Clinic, and I happened to look at a copy of it. I was shown it by an MD, as a matter of fact, and I fell over because the map of that epidemic, it's not an epidemic, it's the endemic disease, a map of the hotspots of valley fever looks almost exactly like a map of the Utoaztecan expansion. And if you overlay a map of the areas where valley fever is endemic, it overlaps beautifully with the areas where Utoaztecan languages were spoken.
What basis would that have in terms of understanding sort of genetics and also epidemiology? Is there something that would make that a sensible association or no?
Well, it appears that coccidioidomycosis originated in tropical Mexico.
Okay.
And it originated in basically the same area that the Utoaztecan languages originated. And it looks like it might be an indicator of migration patterns. But again, I don't want to push this too far because it's a very tentative sort of examination. But it was kind of interesting, at least.
So what's the last little bit of time that we have, where are you taking your research at this point? What particular topics and subjects are you working on? Because I'm sure you have some other articles and projects in the can.
Well, as a matter of fact, I have put most of my rock art work on the back burner now. I probably will get back to it. But at the moment, since I'm in Oregon and no longer have easy access to the rock art there in California, mm-hmm. I've been focusing more on obsidian hydration dating and also on some research with Robert Yowie at Cal State Bakersfield on trying to lay out the prehistoric occupation sequence in Rose Valley, California. Hmm. And we have pretty good data to go from there, and we're in the process of putting this together. So that's kind of where it's going now. That plus, as I say, with obsidian dating, I'm working with Chris Stevenson at the University of Virginia on obsidian science. And we have a paper coming, well, a book chapter coming out shortly, in which we managed to, we think, finally, get valid hydration rates for Bodie Hill's obsidian.
Well, you know, I don't think you're stopping anytime too soon. Sounds like you have many different ambitious projects that are at your fingertips. And God bless you for your energy and your intellect and your enthusiasm, Sandy. You've been virtually a lifelong friend, and I'm just honored to know you and to share your joy and enthusiasm for our cherished profession.
Thank you very much.
Well, that's it, boys and girls, for the 45th Rock Art Podcast. See you next week in a brand new show. See you on the flip-flop.
Thanks for listening to the Rock Art Podcast with Dr. Alan Garfinkel and Chris Webster. Find show notes and contact information at www.arcpodnet.com/rockart. Thanks for listening, and thanks for sharing this podcast with your family and friends. This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV Traveling America, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.